I'm Dustin Harder, and this is Keep On Cooking. Hello, and welcome to Keep On Cooking, the only podcast dedicated to plant-based cookbooks. I'm your host, Dustin Harder, and you better knock, 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 knock on wood. He's my husband and producer of the podcast, David Rossetti. David, dear, how are you?
Good. Are you knocking on my wood?
Well, I've run out of corny jokes to put there, so now I'm just singing. Literally, I'm popping in lyrics. As you know, I am a slot machine jukebox of
a slot machine
of looping.
And that's a good one.
Hits, I suppose, and non-hits. There's a lot of loops that happen in my head of songs that people have never heard of that just live in my world.
Yes, when he's in the kitchen, I hear them quite often over and over.
Can't help it. I have no regret.
Can't stop, won't stop.
Yeah, can't stop, won't stop.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. We're going to get into this book, but we're going to talk about quick the trip we just had to Disney World.
Hey. Remember the magic. Anybody?
Talk about songs that live rent-free in your head that nobody else knows.
Fantasmic.
Well, so we can, let's, you know, we're not going to drone on and on about Disney, but I did want to bring it up because we had some great vegan food there.
We sure did. And clearly marked that we were a little skeptical.
Clearly marked.
Because it doesn't say vegan. What they kept saying?
It says, is made without or does not include animal products. Doesn't it say honey?
Yeah.
Honey, dairy, eggs, which I actually felt pretty comfortable. Like I was like, oh, I'd almost rather, they're being very specific that like it does not have all these things that you would say are in a vegan or plant-based diet, right? But I think they do it because plant-based and vegan, like people get, it's so polarizing and people get so
confused because you can say plant-based but someone's like, see, oh, like it's got like milk or eggs in it,
right?
Well, it's plant-based.
We did have that moment. So we went to this, it's called Chef Mickey's Table, and all the characters are there, mm-hmm. and there's this big buffet, and
we did have a four-year-old with us. We were not doing it just for us, though there is no shame in that.
There's no shame in that. But I will happily
have a four-year-old.
I will happily go back with you, David. Just you.
I may have gotten more excited about Goofy.
You were so excited about Goofy. I got Brianna. A video. I loved it.
Thank you.
We were more excited about the characters, I think, than my great niece, actually.
I think so.
Which is fine. That's great. Minnie's my girl. The minute she came out, we got her picture with her, and I was like, I'm good. I can go home.
Always just good. The shoes, a bevel.
I love her. Well, and you beveled in the photo.
I sure did. I love.
Anyway,
we're professional.
So about the food at Chef Mickey's Table, which is one of their many, many restaurants that you have to make reservations at months ahead of time. Also, if you're considering a Disney trip, just get on your gig, get on the game, make the reservations, do the thing. We did great. David and I did great. We handled it all for my family. We did great. But I'm just saying.
And check. And if you don't have a reservation, check day of.
Check day of.
Morning of. Yep. And stuff
night before. Mm-hmm. There's always cancellations. We had a couple great cancellations that got my mom into a couple places she really wanted to go with my great niece. So it was great. But about the buffet at Chef Mickey's.
The buffet.
Lots of vegan options. The waiter was great. He was like, if you don't see what you want up there, we will send the chef out to you and you can talk to him. But listen, we found everything we wanted up there. My only hiccup there at that buffet is there was someone coming out to refill the buffet. And it was just when we got up there. And I said, hi. Are the options labeled clearly? Like, is there something I should be looking for on the options that let me know that they're vegan? And he was like, no. And then I looked up and the guy next to me goes, did he say there's not a label? And I said, yeah. So I guess we're kind of.
But you saw the leaf and we're what does that mean?
What does that mean? Does that mean it's vegan? And he was like, no. And I was like, well, then why is it on some and not others? He's like, it's vegetables. And I was like, okay, so this is someone who has not been given the proper information. And the guy next to me was like, what does he mean? No. Like, and then this lovely man who was next to me ended up way far away from me down the buffet, came back to me with a little placard in his hand that said the does not contain free
products.
Of animal products, dairy, eggs, honey. He goes, so all the things with the leaf mean this. And I was like, well, that's all I needed. That's amazing.
And we saw it other places too. We saw it other
all
menus
throughout, all throughout the restaurants, so, the parks, everything. And they were very accommodating. If
I will
you
say
asked.
Bravo.
Yes, bravo. So the things we did eat at that buffet, I had an impossible meatloaf. I had a lo mein. I had a huge, my coach would be so proud, my fitness coach, Belinda, shout out. I had a huge, my plate was mostly full of vegetables because that was the beginning of the trip. I knew we was going to be doing some eating, right?
Some damage.
But then also, what did you have on your plate? You had the impossible.
I mean, the impossible meatloaf, the lo mein was really good. I mean, I may have gotten some french fries.
Oh, He got the fries. He got the fries. Well, then at the end, there were no vegan desserts, and I circled the area twice, and he said, well, let him know. And I said, hey.
Which is like, again,
I know.
It's so easy. I would say like baking things is just so easy.
It really is the easiest
because there's
place.
So many easy substitutes and it's like done.
Though I told you I met that one pastry chef that one time who got so like defensive and angry with me when he learned what I do. He was like, well, you just can't do without eggs and butter. And I was like, and it's like, I have to pick and choose my battles because I'm building relationships in other fields to like put plant-based options on menu. So I was like, okay, and listening to him. And then I sort of gave my two cents, but like, he was so, I love it when people are defensive. I'm like, why are you defensive? Like, just try the vegan butter and see what happens. And then you'll be like amazed at how inclusive your food can be and how many people you can serve. Anyways, we're getting on a tangent. All that to say, there was no dessert available on the buffet that was vegan. So I said to the waiter, I said, hey, what's up? Nothing out there is vegan. He goes, oh, we got you. Hold on. He came back to the table with a plate full of and beautifully dressed and garnished chocolate cupcakes with vanilla frosting that had these soft batch little like ginger cookies.
Yeah, gingerbread cookies, but of course shaped like.
So they were stuck into the cupcake. So it looked like, you know, Mickey Mouse. Essentially. But so, So it was just amazing. Like where we didn't have a vegan dessert, suddenly we had this beautiful plate of vegan food in front of us. And I was just like, well, this is amazing.
It's so Disney.
So Disney. But then I was like, well, why are they holding this in the back waiting for it to be asked for? Like, it should just be out here for everyone to enjoy. But
so silly.
Beyond that little hiccup there at the buffet with the one person at the buffet and then also with the dessert, which it wasn't a hiccup. They had the things ultimately, but just in communication kind of. Yeah. The parks just had it. We had our Mickey pretzels that were vegan. Just don't get cheese. I love when notes and blogs say that. Just don't get cheese. What else? I'm going to look up the blog, David, that we were looking at. So you tell them what else we have.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few blogs. Just look, I think, for like the dates, because some things may or may not still be there. So don't count on anything. But we had Korean style impossible short ribs at Epcot that were super tasty and had like rice and these kind of like spring roll type things that also had impossible in them. That was delish.
I mean, there's just a website. I actually don't recall going to this one, but it looks accurate. I don't see a date on it. It's called Vegan Disney World. Point of this is you can really look up just put in vegan Disney World or vegan Disneyland and you're going to find a bunch of blogs who have done the work for you. So you're going to be able to find it. So, okay. You said the Korean ribs, what else did you say?
I said those like spring roll with impossible.
Spring rolls. They had a special name to them. And then we had impossible patty melt with vegan cheese and vegan dressing on it.
And that was Magic Kingdom. And that was on Texas Toast.
And the gentleman who rang up our order, we both were like, hey, vegan, straight up. We're using the V word with you. And he goes, everything on it is vegan. And his confidence was, I said, I enjoy your confidence. He goes, well, I work in the back as well. He goes, I wouldn't be able to tell you that if I did not put these items together myself. And I was like, that's amazing.
And then the guy serving said, like, that's my favorite thing on the menu.
Oh, yeah, which was so cool. So, and then, of course, we had the Dole pineapple whip because hello, vegan and delicious. And I'm sure there were some other bites along the way, but that sort of sums up the major things we had, I think. Oh, there was a vegan crepe in France.
Uh-huh. There was a crepe. I mean, it was buckwheat.
I did not love it. I had one bite and said, you continue onward, David. Yeah, that's all yours.
If it didn't have like the strawberries and berries in it, I don't know. Buckwheat's a hard...
Like I don't mind it. I just wanted I would have sprinkled some powdered sugar on that bad boy or something.
To just give it a little bit more. It was a little too like savory, that buckwheat tartness. You know what I'm talking about?
Well,
like
earthy is a good. Yeah. It's like earthy. A darker flavor. I also paused at that moment because I don't know. I was pretty good this trip. Like I ate as much as I wanted to, but at the same time, I was like, I don't love that, so I'm not going to eat it, which is like a big deal for me because usually in moments like this when it's vegan, I'm like, oh, it's vegan and it's kind of good. I'm just going to eat it. And I was like, I don't love that. I know I'm going to, like, we found Tofutti ice cream in Hollywood Studios. My mom wanted a scoop of ice cream and we found Tofutti ice cream, which
was kind of a little bit, you weren't there for that. There was a little bit of like a, we had to radio.
Oh, like
we had to radio. Oh, we've got somebody that wants. Yeah, it's foodie, and some a manager had to pull it from some like potential like back freezer. They're like, somebody wants this.
Oh my god!
And they like pull it out. It's like in like one of those little small containers, oh, and he's funny. Like scooping it out, and it's like literally the manager that ended up like scooping it and serving.
Well,
and
also Tofutti is like, I mean, I'm just gonna be real. Never my choice for ice cream. I don't even know where I see it.
There's so many other brands now. Like,
I thought it was so weird that we were feeling Disney was very advanced in their vegan offerings and their protocol, but then also not advanced.
Some
I should say
more
up
than
to
others.
Speed. I don't know about advanced. Advanced is a very kind word, but at least like present. And the Tofutti for me, it also said in the blog we were reading, it was like, you have to specially ask for it, which is why David had to do it. So it's not on the menu. If you go to Hollywood Studios, you go to this place called Hollywood Scoops, you can ask for the vegan vanilla ice cream. And it was okay. David and I didn't finish it. Again, another thing I didn't, which for us to not finish ice cream.
It's like a good on the start, 2 minutes in.
We didn't finish ice cream, David.
Though. I know.
Anyway, so that's our trip to Disney in a nutshell, food-wise, so many other things that we won't share because there's a different difference between personal and private, David.
There is. And going to Disney with family, we'll just say that.
Yep. And moving on, here we go. So we are really excited about this book. Chef Priyanka is a star. She's this week's guest. Straight up star, I'm telling you. Chef Priyanka Nayak, known as Chef Priyanka. And we are chatting about her book, The Modern Tiffin on the Go.
Come on, look at this book.
Look at it. So colorful, so delicious.
Gorgeous. I love those colors.
On the Go, vegan dishes with a global flair.
Look at her little picture. Show her little picture.
Oh, she's so, she's also just.
Look at her.
The energy is so good. The good eng. Look at that. Good eng.
So cute.
Priyanka has amassed a fan base online exceeding 200,000 with a loyal following across Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook, and more. So in a sense, she is considered a vegan, sustainability, fashion, and travel influencer, honey. Ooh. She is also quite the TV personality.
Yes, Priyanka has worked across several brands globally, from small businesses to some of the largest brands in the world. She has also been featured across numerous editorial publications, including a full profile on Forbes.
Work.
Priyanka is a self-taught Indian vegan chef and Food Network champion.
But that's not all. Mm. She is a Quibi Dishmantled winner and columnist. Really struggling.
No, it's all right.
Columnist. Sometimes I think I'm having a mild stroke.
It's all right. You're not.
Columnist.
You taste pennies.
No, thank you.
Okay, great.
She's a columnist of Eco Kitchen for the Washington Post and avid traveler who's been to nearly 40 countries. Her globally inspired original recipes have been featured on the Today Show, featured on Today Table, an NBC Peacock TV show. She has been featured on the Kelly Clarkson Show.
Ooh.
I mean, get into it. Kelly Clarkson. She's been featured on Forbes, Glamour, Bon Appetit, miniseries, CNN, GQ, The Beat, Well and Good, Medium. And she's not been on the Today Show only once. No. She's been on the Today Show thrice. Three times, mama.
Get it, girl. Third time is the charm. Priyanka is a first-generation Indian-American raised on Staten Island, New York. Her Indian heritage is very important to her. We can see that in the book. To her cooking style and lifestyle, so much so that she weaves in Indian elements throughout all of her vegan cooking. She attributes her devotion to her Indian roots and passion for Indian food to her loving and supportive parents.
That's right. Priyanka loves, very talks all about it in the book. She talks about it in the interview. I love it. She's very attached to her roots and her heritage and just really sharing it all with her followers, which is fantastic. We all get to learn more. And Priyanka loves to travel just as much as she loves cooking. So when she set out to write this cookbook, she knew it couldn't be just one cuisine. It had to feature a world of plant-based flavors. Drawing on her heritage and her travels, Chef Priyanka introduces you to a world of mouth-watering vegan dishes in The Modern Tiffin. Here she is to tell us all about it. It's Chef Priyanka Nayak. She's Nacho Average Cook, bringing her global flair to television and social media for the masses to get cooking with new and exciting foods that are also rooted in tradition. It's the one and only Chef Priyanka Nayak. Welcome to Keep On Cooking. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, we're going to go right into your icebreaker question. If you could teach a class on one thing that isn't food related, what would it be?
That's a great question. My whole life revolves around food, but I think I would like to teach a class around mindfulness. So I think, you know, those type of words, they're buzzwords and they're kind of recently very trendy, but I'm from a culture, I'm first generation Indian, where, you know, we sort of grew up with being mindful. It's just part of our culture. From everything from how you eat your food, what hand do you accept money with, how do you pray, what goes involved in like before entering a temple. I think I lead my life with that practice of just being very thoughtful and mindful of everything that I do, or I really try to do that. And I think there is a lot of value in it, because then more things that you do on a day-to-day basis have purpose and meaning if you're mindful about your actions and how you think about it. So I would love to teach a class on that. I don't think, you know, I don't have any special certificates. I'm not a doctor of mindful philosophy or anything like that, but
your certificate comes from life. You've been living it and doing it, so you could certainly teach it. I would sign up for it. Even just thinking about when you said food, I was like, oh, that is like a place where I want to be so mindful. You know, you read up on it, being mindful of food when you're eating and everything about where it comes from and how it got to your plate. It's there really is such a beauty in that alone, right? So when you think about mindfulness overall, I would take the class. I'd be there for it. Mine would be, I have, you know, my history before all of this was in theater. So I guess I would want to teach some sort of theater performance class. You know, I feel like theater really brings people together. It's universal in a way. So I think that's where I might go with this. If I were to teach something beyond food, because like you, food is my life. So I was like, you know, what would it be? In this book's intro, you go into detail about food being part of your upbringing. Can you tell us a bit about that and when sort of that all then transitioned into vegan food for you?
Yeah. So I grew up first generation Indian. I'm born and raised in New York City. My parents came to this country in the late 70s. And so they were the only ones who came here. My whole kind of extended family is still in India. And one of the primary ways for us to stay in touch with our culture was through food. You know, anytime we were home, we were very, every meal was very important, from breakfast, lunch to dinner. My mom packed us, me and my sister's lunch every day for school. Like, we weren't allowed to eat school lunch, mainly because there was really no options for us at that time in the 90s. It was just like, not very healthy. And, you know, it was.
Were you eating vegetarian then?
Yeah. That's okay. The other thing. We were fully vegetarian. So food was a huge part of our lives, because not only because of our dietary restriction, but also because that was the way we retained our culture. Mm-hmm. The food that we ate was not, you know, given in restaurants anywhere. It certainly was not like anything that my friends were eating, you know, on Staten Island. So it really was a way for us to stay connected, aside from, you know, going to India every single year of our lives and learning my native language of Kannada before English. Food was kind of the other third key part of staying true to our culture and learning about it.
And when did that shift into, so vegetarian, and when did it shift into vegan for you then?
So we are Maharashtrian, so our cooking style at home, actually a lot of the dishes by default are vegan. We just never called it vegan. It was because a lot of our cooking style is a lot of legumes and vegetables that are sauteed, and we eat a lot of different breads and rices. There is yogurt sometimes present, but we don't really eat cream. We don't eat much dairy or anything like that. So most of our food by default was vegan. But I transitioned to veganism about maybe 6 years ago. What year is it? It's like 6 years.
I'm always trying to add it up to him. Like, I think it's been this much. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Like 5, 6 years ago. And you know, that was mainly for environmental and ethical reasons, but it was also really easy for me because of the way we grew up and all the kind of accessibility to different ideas on how to cook plants and think about plants and all that kind of stuff. So So yeah.
It sounds like you were there already, pretty much. Like you said, there was some yogurt and stuff. And now how easy is that to sort of swap in? You've got all the vegan options on the market. It's just kind of like, oh, well, I can just use this instead. So that's lovely that the transition sort of, it just sort of lent itself to you already. That's great. I see all these cookbooks behind you. I always ask authors when they're on, do you remember what your first vegan cookbook was that you owned, or the first vegan cookbook that you cooked from the most?
Ooh, I actually think this is like opposite. I think it was the one that says Persia.
Okay.
So that actually is not a vegan cookbook, but I got it a long time. I forget who gave it to me, but I got it a long time ago, and there's a really good eggplant dish in there that I had made, which I love eggplant, and we eat eggplant in like all different forms. So I really was drawn to that. I'm trying to think what vegan cookbook I got first.
But that's all right. Your first, the Persian one's one that you hold close, is one of the first ones that sort of resonated with you to cook
maybe
from a lot.
Maybe V-Street?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's like, because, you know, they weren't really a thing for a while. And then all of a sudden, like, everyone had a vegan cookbook out. So it was like, which is great. But, you know.
I love that you say that about eggplant dishes, because as I'm going through your book, I do see the eggplant recipes. Eggplant is one of the vegetables. I love vegetables. Love almost all of them. But eggplant's one that's always a little tough for me, right? What is your favorite way to prepare eggplant then?
I think eggplant gets a bad rep. I think any vegetable that gets a bad rep is because people don't know how to cook it.
Sure.
Eggplant, if you don't cook it well, it's bad. It rips your tongue. It's hard to eat. Like, I don't like any form of badly cooked eggplant, but there's a few ways we make it. My favorite is, which we call badnikai tumbid. Badnikai is eggplant. Tumbid means stuffed. So we cook with baby eggplants a lot, and we make a slit and we stuff it with different masalas and onions and kind of this like paste of all these flavors. You stuff it, you flash fry it, and then you simmer it in this really flavorful sauce that is usually made with onions and garlic. There's not too much ginger in there, but there's kari patta, which is curry leaves, black mustard seeds. And you simmer it in this sauce, and you kind of slow cook it so that the eggplant, now that the outside skin has kind of been flash fried, you want the inside to cook. So you simmer it in the sauce, and then you eat it with chapati, which is like a bread or rice. So that's probably like my favorite version of eggplant. And I have a variation of that in my book, but it's very common.
Sounds delicious.
In different parts of India, but especially in our home, it's very common. Yeah.
I'm like, okay, well, I'll eat that. That sounds amazing. Fantastic. Well, let's dive into the modern tiffin. On the go, vegan dishes with a global flair. Give the listeners a little summary about what this cookbook has to offer.
Yeah, so the modern tiffin is a true culmination of really who I am. It's a culmination of my heritage, my Indian heritage, and my travels. So I've traveled to 40 countries globally, and my travels have really inspired and influenced my culinary style and the type of dishes I cook and the different techniques. And it's all encapsulated in this concept of a tiffin, which is a, actually I can show you what a tiffin is.
Please. Yes. I was hoping you would have some on hand to give us a little glimpse there.
Okay. Let's see. I hope I don't knock anything down. Okay.
I just love the idea of tiffins, and I think they're so beautiful, and I've loved learning more about them as I've been reading through this book. Yes, that's gorgeous.
Yeah. So this is a tiffin. It's basically a steel stacked container set that is then latched. And it's very, very common in India. The concept is like hundreds of years old. And it basically makes food portable. And so the concept is that when people would go to work, this part I don't necessarily like, you know, the men would go to work, and then the women at home, whether it's the mom or the grandma or whomever, would be at home, and they would cook a fresh meal. They would pack it in the tiffin, and then the tiffin wallahs, which are the tiffin delivery guys, would come around, pick up the tiffins, latch it onto their bike, and then bike it down to wherever the people were working and hand deliver it. So it was kind of like Uber Eats, but, right. you know, 200 right. years ago.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the reason why it's so relevant in our culture is because food is such a big deal. So like having a freshly cooked meal at every mealtime is like a big deal in our culture to have fresh food. And it's very, again, like in India, especially, like they're very mindful when they eat. Like they're not eating usually on the go or at the computer. I'm sure generations mm-hmm. have changed now, but it's very like, okay, I'm going to eat now. Right. And like, I'm going to take my tiffin and open it up and eat. And so
I'm going to mindfully yeah. eat my food. Yes.
And I really liked that concept because, you know, I grew up taking my lunch to school every day that my mom packed. And then when I graduated college and entered the workforce, I actually packed my lunch every day for work because one, I didn't want to spend like $20 on like a gross salad for mm-hmm. lunch. So economically, it made more sense to pack food. But two, I had a dietary restriction also. And so just packing my lunch was a better way to just reduce waste, be healthier. And so that kind of concept of packing my lunch and having a tiffin has been so prevalent in my life. And so I wanted to bring that to a new generation and all different types of audiences so people can understand how important it is to cook for yourself. And that's kind of everything that I captured in the Modern Tiffin. So each chapter is focused on a different part of the world mm-hmm. that I've been to. So you have the Italian chapter, the Mexican chapter, the Spanish chapter, the Australian chapter, and all of those dishes in there are inspired by my experiences in those countries.
Well, and your experiences, but also your personality is like bursting off the pages here, right? So we've got, I mean, anyone who follows you knows that you have this lovely, infectious, energetic personality, but then this book is so colorful and just bursting like off the pages sort of at everyone with the illustrations and everything, the beautiful photography and your picture lifestyle shots sort of peppered throughout. So it really is fantastic. And I do love this too. You said about tiffins. So, you know, America, we've got to go containers. We're disposing of, we've got to go containers, Tupperware that sort of like gets gross over a few years and then, you know, gets passed on or passed on by thrown away probably, you know, and then you're talking about tiffins getting passed down through generations. You said you've got one from an uncle and you've got one, I think, that your mom got for as a wedding gift now. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's so special too. You're having this meal yeah. and it's also to me part of the mindfulness. Like you're just having this great meal that for years someone's been eating out of this container, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's dishwasher safe.
So, hey, come on. Some convenience tossed in there with it too. Like it doesn't get better than that. Yeah. Well, you talk about, you know, your roots growing up with food and then your global travels combined to create this book. And you also go about in depth about equipment for the home kitchen to master this cookbook. And to me, it seems what is also most important are the spices. What do you have to offer the listener about spices when it comes to the Modern Tiffin?
I think most importantly, people should just be more open-minded to spices. And I'm not talking about salt and pepper. Salt is a flavor enhancer, not a mm-hmm. spice. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, it's just such an integral part of our cooking. And I'm trying to make it more commonplace for people, you know, in the Western world and in the States. And my one tip is to buy whole spices. So that's like, sorry. Let me mute this.
No sweat. Technical things. It's always a part of it, you know?
But to buy whole spices. So like whole cumin seeds, whole coriander seeds, whole red chilies. And the reason why I say that is one, sometimes they can actually be inexpensive versus the ground spices. Two, when you buy already ground spices, they're already going stale because they've already been ground down to a powder. Their flavor's already emanating. Like you don't have enough of that pack of flavor in there because it's already been ground down. So using whole spices means that you're getting the most flavor and most bang for your buck. And you can use it in versatile ways, right? So we cook with whole spices a lot. We temper whole spices where we heat up oil and then put whole coriander, whole cumin, or whole black mustard seeds, let them pop and temper, and then you add in your aromatics like onion, ginger, garlic, vegetables, mm-hmm. etc. So that concept of cooking can be applied literally to anything. You could apply it to non-veg even if you want to, if there's someone out there who's not completely vegan and wants a better way to cook non-veg food. So I think my tip is always to buy whole spices. Buy them if you can at like an Indian grocery store or Asian supermarket. They'll probably be cheaper. And try to replace them every 6 to 8 months. Mm-hmm. But it's a really great way to add quick flavor to your dishes and to then use those spices in a more versatile way versus just buying ground spices that God knows how long it's been sitting on the shelf.
I'm glad you touched on tempering spices too, because you have some recipes in here where it's part of the title, Tempered Spices. So I was hoping you would elaborate for people. That's great. And the first chapter, we're going to dive right in here. So chapter one is Maharashtrian. Am I saying this correctly?
Maharashtrian
foods. And when you speak about the food, you educate the reader on how Indian is regional, how most of the Indian food at Indian restaurants in America is often referring to North Indian food, and you start off by introducing us to the Maharashtrian foods. I know this was important for you. Please tell our listeners about the regionality of Indian cuisine and the importance of these foods for you in this chapter.
Yeah, so I think because, you know, when growing up here, there was two things, right? Like, we grew up on Staten Island, so no one on Staten Island looks like us. If anyone knows anything about Staten Island, it's the forgotten borough.
I kind of hear the Staten though when you say Staten Island suddenly. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's very homogenous Italian American, now a little bit more Eastern European, but like no one looked like us growing up there, right? So we were definitely the odd bunch out. Then, so you have like that piece. Then the second piece is like any Indian people that we encountered or any Indian restaurants we encountered, they weren't our type of Indian, right? They were usually Punjabi, which is North Indian, or Gujarati, which is another state in India. And so there was really no one we could like relate to, right? In that regard, like our food was different, our language was different, the way our names were a little bit different. And so again, that's where food became so important to us, to just stay in touch with our culture and our language and the style of our specific regional culture. And I want people here to understand that, because like most countries, India is massive and very, very regional. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily fair to be like, oh, I love Indian food. And then it's just like garlic naan and chicken tikka masala, which, by the way, isn't even Indian. It's a British colonialized dish that was developed in the Mughal Empire in North India, right? So it's like not even Indian, quote unquote. And no hate on it. Great dish. Great, you know, tastes great.
Sure,
but
like, sure.
It's not representative of the regionality of the country. So that's right. Why I opened that chapter, because I'm specifically Maharashtrian, which is Mumbai and a little bit south of that. And I want people to see the versatility and just like the diversity and within India itself.
I love in that intro, you were like, you know, the tikka masala and garlic naan, you guys can take a back seat for now, basically. You're like, no shade, but like, we're going to talk about some other stuff this time, you know?
Yeah.
I've actually made the bel puri for a private client that I had once upon a time, and I wish I had had this book for it. You've got the spicy chick, because I don't know how, he said it was good. I really don't know how well I did. You know, I was looking up recipes, doing my best.
I'm sure it was great.
I mean, it tasted good to me. I just don't know if how close to the mark I actually got, you know. And you've got a spicy chickpea bel puri in here. Can you explain to our listeners what that is?
So bel puri is a very popular Indian street food dish from Mumbai. And like, we really like our snacks and like our street food dishes. I personally do too. I have like a junk food tooth or whatever. I like things that are like crunchy and fun to eat and have all different textures and like are sweet and spicy. And there are just so many dishes in India that are like that. And so bel puri is traditionally made on the street side, where it uses different chudas, which are like puffed rice, and like shave, which is made from chickpea flour, like all these different crispies that are then tossed with a boiled potato, chopped boiled potato, chopped tomato, raw onion, which I hate raw onion, but they put raw onion in it, fresh coriander. And then they also put different chutneys in it. So tamarind chutney, which is like sweet and tangy. And then a green chutney, which is made from usually coriander or mint, and it's very spicy. Mm-hmm. And so you mix all of that together and it's served in like a newspaper cone. And then you just eat it on the go. I personally love it. It's just, it's really fun to eat. It's really delicious. So I wanted to bring that concept to people here, but make it a little bit healthier. So I use chickpeas, and I know people love chickpeas. I like chickpeas, mm-hmm. but you know, chickpeas are accessible and they add a lot of protein and a lot of texture. So when you make this dish, you'll feel like you're eating something hearty. It's not just like some like a snack, but it can be eaten as an appetizer or a side sure. dish or a snack. But yeah, it's really fun. It's a fun dish.
It was fun. It was fun to make. And it was, I think the chutneys are what I was most nervous about too, because I was like, I felt like there's more than those two, right? I feel like there's yeah. so many variations of it. So I was just like, but he seemed all right. But anyway, what about the modern shabu dani? Tell us more about that.
Oh, so shabudani or shabudana is a dish that is also Maharashtrian. It is, we usually eat it every Saturday when we're fasting. We do this fast for Shiva, which is one of our gods. And he's like our main, he's like the main god of our family. So we do this Shiva fast. My dad mainly does it. And during that fast, you don't eat any, you can't eat any like ginger and garlic and aromatics. So then there's like a specific foods that you eat. One is shabudani. Shabudani is traditionally made with tapioca. So white pearl tapioca. Most people I think are familiar with like the black boba tapioca in drinks or tapioca and tapioca pudding. So this is the tapioca that's in tapioca pudding that you would get like at a grocery store. So it's white pearl tapioca. You clean it the night before and you soak it. You clean it the night before, you rinse it underwater, and then you let it sit outside covered and it puffs up. And then the next day, you have to give it that time to kind of like absorb the water and like soak it in. The next day, you then saute it with peanuts, green chilies, curry leaves, whole cumin seeds, and a little bit of salt and fresh coriander. It's a very simple dish, but the key is retaining that texture of that tapioca. It can get very chewy very quickly. So you have to be, I would say, a skilled cook to actually know how to cook it. I'm biased. My mom makes the best shabudani.
Of course she does. Please. Are you kidding me?
So I you know, we love that dish. We eat it every Saturday when we're all together as a family. And so I wanted to bring the flavors of that dish, but again, make it accessible to people because not everyone has access to, you know, white pearl tapioca. And so pearl couscous is a really great substitute because it has the same size, a little bit of the same texture. But obviously it's like a starch, right? So, which is fine. But that's the substitute that I use for the shabudani. So that's why I call it the modern shabudani.
Nice. I mean, I think one of the coolest things about writing a cookbook, especially in the vegan landscape, is trying to make things, as you're writing it, you're trying to consider the home cook and how you can make it most accessible to everyone. So I love this approach to that. I think that's great. Chapter two, you visit South Indian cuisine. But before we talk about the food, I thought it was interesting to learn how you navigate your native language and how it came about, essentially, regionally speaking. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So my family speaks two main languages, Kannada, which is a South Indian language. It's from the state of Karnataka, and then Marathi, which is from the state of Maharashtra. We are a Maharashtrian by like regional definition because we're from Mumbai, and my mom's side of the family is from an area that is kind of a bordering city of Karnataka and Maharashtra. So we are Maharashtrian by region, but by language, we speak those two languages, not only because of the location, but also because of our specific kind of religious background. And I use that word loosely because Hinduism is not really a religion. It's a spiritual belief system. It's more of like a philosophy. So it's not really like there is some specific rhetoric or book that we're following, which would define more of a traditional religion, which mm-hmm. is why Hinduism is not really defined as a religion. But we are specifically Lingayat, which means like we are Shiva, which is that god that I mentioned. We are Shiva worshipers. So like that's like the main god we quote unquote worship. And this sect of people who are Lingayat, the main language that's spoken within that is Kannada. So that's why that is one of our main languages. And my parents taught us Kannada and kept Marathi as a secret language. So they would like talk in Marathi in front of us. So we couldn't really necessarily understand it.
Some smart parenting right there.
I know, but we're fluent in Kannada because that's, you know, we communicate with our entire family because both sides speak Kannada. Sure. We like communicate with our entire family in Kannada. So it's like,
okay,
we weren't disabled in any way.
Right. Now, what about you personally then with all this travel? Do you speak, how many languages do you speak? Do you speak more?
So I wish honestly I spoke more. I'm conversational in Spanish. I'm fluent in Kannada. I understand Hindi and like can speak it a little bit, mainly because from watching so many movies when we were sure. little, like Hindi movies, Bollywood movies. And that's really it, unfortunately. Okay. Like I wish I spoke more because
I mean, hey, you're doing good.
I know, but when you go to these countries, like people are speaking yeah. like 6, 7, 8 languages, yeah. and I'm like, damn, I suck.
There's still time. I have no doubt. I have no doubt in your lifetime you're gonna put some more languages under your belt. So I'll be watching out. Do you have videos that you do on social media in different languages at all?
No, I don't. Gonna say,
I feel like I've seen them all in English, but I'm maybe just something to think about. A little something.
I know. We've got to cut it out video.
Well, with the South Indian cuisine chapter, there are items like the savory chickpea flour pancakes with tempered spices, coconut yogurt rice, red chili and mustard seed apple slaw, sounds so good, and spiced rub cauliflower steaks with pistachio and cilantro gremolata. I love a gremolata. These all sound delicious, but tell us more about the saffron shiro with cardamom and butter golden cashews.
Yes. So this is a very, it's a dessert. It's a sweet, but it's kind of like a village sweet. Like it's not, it's not like anything fancy. Like the ingredients are fancy, but you know, those are ingredients that are like staples across Indian cooking, mm-hmm. right? Like cashew and saffron. And this sweet actually is usually made and served in temples as like an offering, as a prasad okay. is what we call. But usually we make it during like festival time, or if there's like Diwali or something like, you know, something fun and religious that's like going on, like in Hindu culture, we'll make shira. It's quite a simple dish. You just take rava or semolina, you dry fry it or dry toast it over the stove. And then once it's like nutty, you then add in some water to then help the cooking process. And you add some saffron in while it's still liquidy. So it gets like the nice golden color and has like a lot of that saffron flavor in there. And then separately, you just toast up some cashews. They usually do it in ghee, but you know, you could do it in coconut oil or sure. vegan butter. And they also add raisins. I hate raisins though. So,
does this one not have raisins in it? Does your version not have raisins?
I don't think I put raisins. Yeah, maybe cranberries or something. Then you put some cardamom in it as well, and then you top your once your shira is done, you top it with the cashews and the raisins and some more cardamom. Yeah,
sounds delicious, and it sounds celebratory. So I, you're saying, you know, you do it for special occasions, essentially. So it sounds yeah. about right. Well, chapter 3 is the Italian. I can tell people why it's called the Italian, but I've got you here. So why is the home cook finding a chapter called the Italian in the middle of this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I always joke that I feel like I'm half Italian because I grew up on Staten Island. So yeah. It's just like you know, we, I grew up around so many Italian people, like the only thing to eat on Staten Island is Italian food and like really good Italian American and Southern Italian food. And so I've been spoiled in that regard to have exposure to this type of cuisine from a very young age. And I've also been to Italy several times, like all parts of Italy. So I have, you know, I have the perspective from like the Italian American side and then the perspective from like the actual Italian side. So
do you have a favorite place in Italy?
That's a good question. I do. I like Bologna. I think it's really underrated. I had a friend who lived there for school for a bit. So I visited her and, you know, otherwise I would have not gone there because it's not necessarily like on the list of places to visit. But I really loved it because that is the capital of like pasta. That's where a lot of the different pasta dishes were created. Great.
How do people not talk about this more often then?
I know. It's right by Parma, which is where like the what's his name? The famous Italian chef. What's his name? Oh my god, he was on Chef's Table. He has glasses. He's super famous. Why am I? It starts with an M.
Someone will tell us. Someone will pop up and tell us. It's okay. We'll find out. Someone in the comments, tell us.
I know. So that whole region is like very foodie focused. And I just loved the food there because the pasta dishes were so creative. Like, I think in Italy in general, like, outside of Rome, and the other thing is Bologna is like not touristy, right? Which I love. It's like touristy places. Like I don't want to be catered to when I go to places, right? Like I just want to like discover what you guys are doing on your own.
Yeah.
Like,
you want to see what's actually happening. Yeah.
Right. And so basically they would make these really beautiful pasta dishes that were so fresh with like a ton of veggies, like no cream, no cheese. And it was just like, everything was so delicious on its own that like you didn't need much to it. Yeah. So I really enjoyed that. I also really enjoyed Naples, which I think is underrated. So Naples is like a little bit grungy and I like that because like I'm a New Yorker and like I like cities that are a little bit like have a little bit of grit to them because again, like I don't like the super touristy places. And I went to the super famous pizzeria there, the Pizzeria di Michele, which is like the oldest pizzeria like in Italy or Naples. Wow. And like, they only make two styles of pizza. It's the one that Julia Roberts went to in Eat, Pray, Love.
Okay.
And they make two styles of pizza. One is a margherita with like fresh mozzarella. And then the other one is a marinara, which is, there's no cheese on it actually. So
right,
it is.
Right.
And like, it was so good. It was, just, and they don't cut the pizza, right? That's that style in Naples where it's just like served whole. Mm. The dough is very soft, but the crust is really like,
I'm so here for it.
It was really good. And, you know, I love food in Italy. I also do appreciate Italian American food, but they're obviously very different. So I wanted to sort of combine my upbringing here of having that experience with Italian American food, as well as everything that I've experienced in Italy, and sort of kind of try to put it together to create dishes that I felt like were a culmination of both plus my own heritage.
Sure. Did you go to a place called Chubacatuba? It's got a strange name to it like that in Naples.
Where is it?
It's in Naples. We filmed there with my show, The Vegan Roadie. We did season 3 in Italy. And I want to speak to, because people always say, well, you must have been like so full and like you must like after... We left, me and the crew, and we were like, we got on our scales when we got home after 3 weeks filming, and we were like, we didn't gain a pound. We ate so much food, but like you were saying, I want to speak to this because everything is so fresh. It was like the best tomatoes you'll ever have in your life because they're just being grown down the street. It's not, you know, food that's been shipped across the miles. So it really is fantastic. Well, what is an item you would tell someone who just got the book to make first from this chapter, from the Italian chapter?
I think my masala chickpea bruschetta, that's one of my most popular dishes. I'm a huge fan of bread and things on bread, but I love this dish because to me, it's like a true culmination of me, like someone who's Indian who grew up around Italianness, and like the topping is very Indian, but the actual like the vessel of it and the technique of it is very Italian. And so it's a fairly simple dish to make. It's a crowd pleaser. It's really great as an appetizer, but you could even like cut the bread as like a hero style or a sub and put in it and make like yourself a sub with it, so you don't
and
have
it's
to
got
just...
If I recall the recipe, it's doesn't it have a yogurt on it, and then it's got the chickpea masala, but it's also got pomegranate seeds, does it? Am I making that up? That's right.
No, you're right. Yeah,
it looks so yummy. It's on my list, that's why I'm remembering all of it too, because I was poring over it. I was like, oh, I need to put a post-it on it and make this one. The bucatini a la pumpkin with pink peppercorn and pistachio, also on my to-do list. The bucatini might be my favorite pasta.
Yeah.
I just love it so much.
I made that with Kelly Clarkson.
Hey! Did she love it?
Yeah, she said that. And she was like, I'm going to make this for my kids, because she was like, my kids at the time, she was like, my kids only eat three things that are like beige color. So I think they'll eat this. I'm like... Yeah,
do it. In there, you get some vegetable in there. She said, my life would suck without you, after she tried that pasta. Everyone, Kelly Clarkson fans there, working in a Kelly Clarkson song. You've also got Indian risotto in here with tempered spices, Indian stuffed mushrooms, cauliflower, saffron pasta. Everything looks so yummy. And chapter four, we dive into the American comfort chapter. Now, what's a dish from this? If someone's having guest over or dinner party or something like that, what's something from the American comfort chapter that they would make, you would say, make this, definitely make this. It's going to be a crowd.
Definitely the tadka mac and cheese with Cajun breadcrumbs.
Mm.
It's a really good dish to make ahead. And it's just really good in general. Like mac and cheese, I always have had an issue with, because obviously it's so heavy. And I just find that it's always lacking flavor for me. It's just so salty and cheesy, but like, I don't know. I just need something more in it to feel like I'm eating something yummy and savory. And that's kind of what the tadka mac and cheese does. So tadka, which is the same thing as tempered spices, it's flash frying spices and basically mixing that into the mac and cheese and with some turmeric. So it has a really beautiful yellow color. And then I top it with these Cajun breadcrumbs, which we can make from stale bread or old bread. And you just pop it in the oven, and it's really, really good. Like you'll never even know that it's vegan, actually.
Right, right.
The flavors of it too kind of really help bring everything together.
Well, and I saw when I was looking at it, because this is another one I've put a post-it on. When I'm looking at it, it is about the flavor, right? So often vegan mac and cheese, it's like when it's great, but there's other times when it's just sort of like salty, and then they use like just store-bought stuff, and it's just kind of the flavor just dissipates into the plain pasta and you're like, okay, well, this is sort of a waste of my meal. Why did I do this? You know? But this one sounds flavorful and amazing. I saw you make the chili maple skillet cornbread on the Today Show. It looks so good. I almost jumped up and made it right away. And I love playing with variations on cornbread. So this chili maple spoke to me. I want to mention though, thank goodness you were there on camera, because that was one of the ones where it was virtual. You were on the other side and I saw the ones they made in studio and then the one you made on camera. And I was like, I want hers. Yours looked so good. It just looks so puffy and thick and delicious. You put that big scoop of butter on. Oh, so good.
I know. I really wish I was in studio for that one, because
it's one of those things. You were like, don't show that. You don't need to show that again. That's fine. That's fine. Just,
just
focus on the one I'm showing here. That's fine. There's also a masala grilled cheese I want to mention in here. You've also got that in there. We can't not let listeners know about that. Chapter five is the Indo-Chinese, which you say is very popular in India. Tell us more about this cuisine.
Yeah, honestly, like I make fun of it in the book too. I'm like, someone definitely like made this up in India and it just became popular. But it's the concept of combining Chinese and Indian flavors together, which totally makes sense, because like there are so many styles that overlap between our cooking, like Szechuan, dry pot, like very spicy, like sauteing and flash frying, all that kind of stuff. There's so much of that in Chinese cuisine as well as in Indian cuisine. So this concept is just taking like some of those concepts and making it like Indian-ish. So and honestly, there's nothing like, I don't think there's anything quote unquote authentic about it. It's just really good. So like, there'll be so many like noodle dishes that are, they're using lo mein and noodles that you would see in Chinese cuisine, but then they just have some like Indian flair to it, right? Some like Indian chilies, or like they'll use a lot of like Indian ketchup, which is basically the Maggi brand ketchup that's Indianified for India, but it's like spicy and a little bit sweet. So they'll use that a lot to make the different sauces for the noodles.
That's so
then you
good.
Have gobi Manchurian, which is using cauliflower to make the Manchurian balls, like vegetable meatballs. And then they're like simmered in this like sweet and spicy, like Szechuan style sauce. So, honestly, the cuisine is amazing. Like, we get a lot of it here too in New York and New Jersey, but I couldn't let this book go by without having that cuisine in there, because I feel like only Indian people know about it. And I'm like, other people should know about this too. It's really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you've got at the top of the chapter, you have just tofu, and we're not talking about making a block of tofu from scratch. You're talking about seasoning it and cooking it. So what flavors make this tofu at the top of this chapter in terms of and the flavor and the technique? How are we making the tofu Indo-Chinese in this chapter?
I think that the dish you're referring to, I think it's tofu 65, maybe the dish. I think.
Let's see. Good. I opened up right. Tofu 65. I must have thought that was a page number. So then tell us more about that. Why is it called tofu 65 then?
So that is my riff on the chicken dish called chicken 65.
Okay. I thought you were giving us like a canvas to sort of create this tofu, but this is great. Okay. Tell us more about tofu 65 then.
It's like a South Indian Asian-ish dish, which honestly, like the history of it is questionable. My dad used to joke with us when we were little, which was a very cruel joke. He was like, oh, it's called tofu 65 because this chicken is 65 days old. And we'd be like, dad, like, that's not cool. Like, and he's like pure veg. Like, he's never touched meat in his life, but he'll make jokes like this. And we're like, that's not funny, dad. And like, I don't think that's what it is. I think it's like the spices used in it or something to that effect. Honestly, like I'm not entirely sure, but it's a really good dish. Like, it's the way the spices and the masala that they use in it are really good. And it's very heavy on curry leaf. Okay. But there's like an Asian twist to it a little bit. And so I love that flavor profile. So I wanted to bring it to tofu because tofu is obviously a healthier option. It's vegan. And that's kind of how my tofu 65 was born. And, you know, again, tofu gets so much hate, but the way I see it is like, it's kind of like a grilled chicken breast. Like, who's eating, and I know people do, but who's eating like a plain grilled chicken breast? Like, that's gross, right? Yeah. Like, in the same way, like, I'm not sitting there eating like a plain block of tofu. That's gross. It doesn't taste like anything. So I use it as my blank canvas. Like, here's my blank canvas. It's neutral and I could do anything to it. And tofu really absorbs flavor as well. So in this dish, I actually coat the tofu in a little bit of cornstarch and do a little flash fry so it gets crispy. And then separately, I make the sauce and like saute it with that sauce. So you have a little bit of texture on the tofu and it really then picks up the sauce of the tofu 65. So you don't feel like you're eating like gross, bland tofu.
Yeah, I mean, hey, anything you can do to spice up the tofu is great. And tofu 65 sounds like a winner, especially now that I know where it's coming from. Come on, tofu 65, coming through. You have Indo-Chinese pulao, chili garlic cashews, veggie Manchurian noodles, and ginger and red pepper Japanese eggplant. And I can't wait to try the Manchurian noodles. And the next chapter is the South Asian chapter for chapter 6. You explain you thought long and hard on this title, and I think it's important. Tell the listeners why.
Yeah, so I think there is kind of a lot of, not controversy, but there are, you know, nomenclature is very important, right? And so I think it's important to obviously respect the countries and the cultures that you're speaking about and also the food associated with it. And the reason why I refer to this chapter as South Asian is because there is, you know, we're all sort of part of Asia, and Asia is huge. I mean, I think like Russia is part of Asia. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important for us to, as much as possible, to identify the specific regionalities and countries of the different specific regions within Asia that you're talking about. So to me, India is an Asian country, and it to me it's like it's kind of standalone because it's where I'm from, and it's also massive. And south of that or southeast of that are a whole bunch of other, you know, Asian countries like Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, and there's a lot of shared cultures between these countries, India included, right? Because there's been through trade, through colonization, through cross-pollination. There's so much that is shared amongst these countries, not only through food, but also through lifestyle, through religion. So they're a lot more similar than we realize. And I've only been to Thailand. I have not been to Vietnam or Cambodia or Laos or any of those yet. And I've been to Japan, which is far more east of that. But to me, their cuisine I love from what I've like tasted and experienced. And so I wanted to be able to highlight something that I really like while still respecting those cultures. And so that's kind of how this chapter came about. And it's also aspirational for me because I want to go to those countries eventually, which hopefully I will soon. So
you will, I have no doubt. What's one of your favorite dishes to make from this chapter?
The tamarind tofu banh mi. Like that dish is, and it's really good. And I know there's a lot of tofu banh mi's out there, but this one I love because I marinate it with tamarind. And I think that really makes a difference. Just in terms of the caramelization on the tofu, the flavor profile, like it all just goes so well together. And it's really easy to make. Like you can marinate the tofu ahead of time and just keep it in your fridge.
Oh, sounds so good. And everyone listening, there is such a great variety in here with Vietnamese style vermicelli noodles, Bangkok inspired street noodles, peanut sauce dressing, and toasted coconut chili peanuts. There's pages and pages of great stuff to try in here. Chapter 7 brings us to the Mexican chapter, full of goodies like chipotle, black bean, and corn tostada, green chutney quesadillas, poblana torta, masala esquites, and mango gazpacho. I want to make it all, but what is a must-have for you? When you started writing this chapter, what recipe was one you knew had to be in this chapter?
Oh, that's a tough one. I really, really like Mexico, and I've been several times to all different parts of it. And I would say like after India, Mexico is like so accessible from a food standpoint for vegetarians and vegans. And it's just, I don't know, it's just so yummy. That's a tough one. I really
you're like, I wanted them all in there.
I know. I really like tostadas because I think they're fun to eat. And I had so many delicious ones in Mexico City. And I just wanted to bring some of my experience to the book. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, like, I hope I did the tostadas justice. But again, it goes back to me liking crunchy, like snacky style foods. So I think the tostada is really fun to eat. So that's probably something I definitely wanted in there. But a close second is the torta, which is like a pressed sandwich, because I think they're underrated. And I had really good tortas in Mexico made with nopales, which is cactus. And again, it's a simple dish, but it's so good. And I really like sandwiches too. As you can see, I like the banh mi. Like I just like
delicious.
Biting into things. Yeah.
Sandwiches are fantastic. I love me a good handheld. And chapter 8 is the Spanish chapter. I've made the pan con spicy tomate from here actually. And I love it. It was so delicious with the tomato, the chili pepper, the garlic, and the cumin on crusty French bread. Everybody get into it. And so easy to make. What's a favorite of yours from the Spanish chapter?
I do like that one. That's a really, really good one. I don't know, maybe the paella, because that's like a paella combined with a very, you know, popular Indian rice dish called biryani. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was fun. I'm not even a huge rice fan, which I feel like is sacrilegious for me to say as a brown person.
Even as you were saying it just now. Well, just in general, I feel like everyone loves rice. So when you said, I was like, you don't like rice?
I'm like, yeah, I'm not into it. I don't know. But I like fun rice dishes. So, and I do like paella, especially when it gets crispy on the bottom. Like I do like that style of like rice cooking. So I think this dish is really fun because it combines like my favorite parts of each of those rice dishes in one. I also really like loved the name that I came up with it, because instead of paella, it's baella with using a B, because I'm like trying to incorporate the biryani aspect of it. So
I mean, hey, and also when we're talking about rice in this, I was thinking too, I was like, everyone knows you're a pasta gal. You're a pasta gal. And that's all right. That's great. You can own it.
Yeah, exactly.
The next chapter I'm so jealous about. Chapter 9 is the Australian. You talk about it being on your bucket list, and now you've ticked it off, which is why I'm jealous. It's definitely still on my bucket list. And I love what you said about the food and the ingredients in here, and just that you were surprised that the food was so amazing. And I was too, hearing all about this delicious food from Australia. And then you've got this chocolate cardamom macadamia butter. It sounds so dreamy. Like, just that alone sounds so dreamy. What's one of your favorite things that you were able to create for this chapter, reflecting on your travels in Australia and all of the amazing food that you had?
There's two dishes that I really like from that chapter. One is super basic, but it's the avocado toast that I created for that chapter, because I don't know if most people know that avocado toast originates from Sydney. In like 1993 or something on Bondi.
I had no idea.
Yeah, like that basic brunch thing that girls always eat. It is an Australian dish. And I discovered that when I went to Australia and I was on Bondi Beach, and like, that's how I learned about it.
Wow.
And, you know, to be honest, the taste of the avocados, I mean, everything there tasted so much better, because people have to understand that most of these things are indigenous to Australia because of its topography, its climate, all of that. And then they're not really importing much because they're so far and they grow everything. So automatically everything you're eating there, like literally the macadamia nut milk that I had, I was like, oh my God, this is like the best. Like, it's like someone squeezing macadamia nuts and milk into my, like, it was so good. Like, you just needed a little bit, because you could, like, here I feel like I need to eat 10 tomatoes to feel like I'm eating a tomato, right? Like there, I ate one tomato and I'm like, wow, this is really good. So I love the avocado toast dish that I created, because I combine it with a very, like a chutney. We make a lot of dry chutneys at home. That's like part of the type of Indian we are. Like, to your point earlier, like, we have so many chutneys, like hundreds of chutneys.
Yeah.
We make a lot of dry chutneys. So we make like 50 variations of peanut chutney. And I combine the avocado toast with a peanut chutney that like we kind of usually make at home, because I really like that spicy, salty bite, because avocado is so bland. Mm-hmm. So I top the avocado toast with that chutney and pomegranate. And I just really like that whole combo. And the other one is the watermelon roast salad, because I base that off of a famous cake at Black Star Pastry Bakery in Australia. And it was a cake that I ate, but I just love that concept, and I love watermelon and I love rose, and I wanted to like make it into a savory salad-y dish. So that's how the watermelon rose salad was born. And it's very beautiful to look at. So those would be my two favorites from the book, from that chapter.
Both have great photos with them. Both of those do. So both very beautiful to look at. And chapter 10 is the Middle Eastern. You speak to the variety for vegans and vegetarians in Middle Eastern food. And this chapter showcases that in with sweet and tangy Brussels sprouts, spinach stuffed eggplant rolls with mint walnut crunch, and this almond tahini cake with rose syrup and pistachio. It looks so good. But of course, we've got a falafel here, and yours is cleverly paired pear with falafel pear and lettuce wraps. Tell us about these lettuce wraps.
Yeah, so I love falafel. I mean, what vegetarian or vegan doesn't? But I wanted to pair it with, I had created this recipe years ago for a pop-up where I made these pear lettuce wraps. And I don't know how I came up with it, but I really just wanted to combine like pear or apple with cumin. Like, I love the concept of like fruit with savory. And I made these lettuce wraps. And I knew they were a hit because my dad liked them. And my dad doesn't like, he's so picky. He's very, very picky. So I was like, okay, these are good. Like, I'm pretty sure these are good, right? Because he doesn't like a sweet thing and like a savory thing. So I'm like, okay, if he likes this, like, I think this is a good pair. So in my mind, I was like, imagine if I combined this with falafel. Like, that would be such a cool party dish. And the reason why I do it in the lettuce wrap is because the falafel itself is pretty heavy. Like, there's a lot of like chickpeas and stuff in there. The pear adds another dimension. If you put it in a pita, like, you can, but but it's just so much food that I wanted to keep it light and fresh. And that's why I did it in the lettuce wrap. So, you know, you could feel better about us eating falafel, but you can easily put it in a pita or whatever you want. But the combo is really good.
It sounds delicious. And it's funny when you talk about, you know, your dad's sort of stamp of approval. With my mom, it's like, she doesn't like tofu, but if I give her some of tofu and she likes it, I'm like, oh, great. I can serve this to everyone then. I know this is going to be fine. We finished things off with the drinks chapter, chapter 11, the creamy mango coconut frosé, come on, and the unicorn rose refresher are screaming out to me right from the beginning. But what's your favorite drink from here?
Those two are great. I also like the saffron lassi because I make it obviously with coconut yogurt. It's just a different take on lassi. It's more luxurious. I really love making saffron syrups and just keeping it in the fridge and, you know, drizzling it on things and making lassis with them. And the cardamom also helps balance the sweetness of it. So I do love that. It's very visually beautiful.
Fantastic. And my friends, that is The Modern Tiffin by Chef Priyanka Nayak. Priyanka, now's the time for your book brag. What is something you're most proud of when it comes to The Modern Tiffin cookbook?
There are so many things. I mean, to be honest, like talking very candidly, like just selling the concept to a publisher.
Yeah, that's its own hill in itself, yeah, mountain.
I don't think people talk about that enough. You know, publishing is a very interesting industry. It's very archaic, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, not to get too negative or anything, but it's not very diverse. And so when you're trying to sell a concept, which is vegan at baseline, which, you know, at the time, you know, was not like a hot selling thing. Sure. And then on top of that, I'm adding this concept of Tiffin's, and it's just kind of a little bit weird. Like it was a process to get it, you know, for someone to really believe in it. And so I think that in itself is a huge feat for me. And the other thing is I worked primarily with all women on this. Like the photographer that I chose was Melissa Holm. She's of Chinese background. Like I specifically chose her because I wanted to work with someone who was of a different background, but not the same background as me, because I wanted to kind of her to bring her own take to it, but also understand the nuances of my background. The illustrator is actually one of my best friends. She's also of Chinese background, female. You know, I like love the illustration part of the book because
it's so the photos and the illustration, really, it's so great.
So cute. Yeah, like I'm a very animated, like colorful person, and I wanted to really bring that through the book. And it's funny because so many people message me and they're like, oh my God, my kids love your book because they think it's like a coloring book. And I'm like, oh, that's so cute. Like, I'm not even super into kids, but I love that the kids like the book because I'm a kid at heart. And so I'm really kind of proud of the visual of the book because, you know, I think for me, if someone hasn't met me, I want them to read that book and feel like, wow, like I really know who she is. I could tell who she is. And I'm really proud of that. But also like the last thing, most important thing I think is honoring my family and my culture. Like all the fabrics used in the book are like my mom's saris or the saris that my mom's mom sewed for us. Like everything is very, like going back to the beginning of this conversation, everything was very mindfully done in the book. Like there is no part of that book that I, you know, didn't have some like a say in. Like every element you see in the photo is something that I chose or something of my mom's or something of my dad's. And so for me, it's very important to be mindful and approach your life sustainably. So like I used everything that I had. I didn't like purchase anything, you know, new. And I'm very proud of that because I hope to do that for my next book too. I think it's really important to just, again, just be thoughtful about what you do.
Yeah, it's sort of books are a great sort of time capsule of a certain time as well, right? And you've got, since it's your first one, you brought so much to it from, you know, beginning to where you are now. And I think, you know, all wonderful, great things to be proud of, but mission accomplished, I just want to say, because I do feel in reading this book, holding it in my hands, I get a true sense of who you are and how it all started and where it's going. So I love that so much. Are you ready for your rapid fire baker's dozen round of questions?
Uh-oh, do I get a baker's dozen of cookies at the end of this?
Hey, I will bring you cookies next time I'm in New York. Don't put me to the challenge, because I will do it. I love to bring people cookies. You ready to roll?
Okay.
Here we go. Number one, food on a skewer or a tiny spoon?
Skewer.
favorite kitchen tool?
Mortar and pestle.
Yes. What's an item on your nightstand right now?
Oh, my Osea bed sheet like spray. It's like a calming, it's like a vasovagal nerve spray to help calm you before you
love that
bed.
Very good.
Terrible sleeper.
Same here. Maybe I'll have to look into the spray. What's a favorite sauce on pasta?
Oh, my spinach jalapeno pesto.
I just saw that. That's up, y'all, on Instagram. Go check it out. And I think I know this, but let's go for it anyways. What's your favorite pasta shape?
It's two, bucatini or my giant fusilli. So
come on, giant fusilli. I love it. Go to COVID snack when in isolation.
Oh, I did a lot of crackers with peanut butter and like salt and like a sweet and savory type of situation. That sounds so ghetto, but yeah.
You kind of go with what you could get during COVID too. So, I mean, you're trying to do gourmet stuff sometimes out of peanut butter and crackers. I get it. Favorite food to travel with in your Tiffin? Something that pops to mind.
It's not really a food, but I do travel with dates a lot.
Okay. All right. I mean, because that's a food.
Like, that checks filling, out. Nourishing. Yeah. And it's like not gross and it doesn't smell.
Yeah. And you're not getting a candy bar. You're having a date and sort of getting your sweet tooth going there too. Favorite spice to cook with?
Whole cumin seeds.
Favorite vegetable?
Oh, okra.
If you could live in any country, no restrictions on money, whatever, anything, what country would it be?
That's hard. I don't know. Australia?
There you go. This can change down the line. We'll say Australia for now. That's great. A TV game show not food related, do you think you might excel at?
Oh, Family Feud.
Ah, very good. What's your most used emoji?
The
smirk and the shrug. But have you noticed, at least for me, I type in smirk and smirk, the smirk emoji doesn't come up. I always have to type something else in, I feel like.
Well, mine's a smirk and the rolling eyes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Same's here a little bit. And your last one, currently right now, a favorite vegan restaurant local to you?
Ooh, yes. Coletta. It is, Coletta is by Chef Guy, who is a friend of mine. He's the one who started Beyond Sushi.
Fantastic. Here.
Great restaurant. They have a brick oven. They make like their own pizzas. Really good.
Delicious.
Italian.
Come on now. Well, you did it. Well done. That was your rapid fire. Everyone, go get your copy of this gorgeous book. Gorgeous, gorgeous book, Modern Tiffin, here by the stunning and talented Priyanka Nayak. The Modern Tiffin on-the-go vegan dishes with a global flair everywhere books are sold. Go grab it. Priyanka, where can everyone find you on the internet and on social media?
You can find me at Chef Priyanka on all the social platforms or www.chefpriyanka.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being here with me today, Priyanka. I have really enjoyed learning more about you and this fantastic book. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Keep On Cooking. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a review if you like the podcast. It helps a lot.
Yeah. And get more information on the podcast, Dustin's Cookbooks, the Vegan Roadie series, and sign up for our newsletter at veganroadie.com.
And of course, follow us at The Vegan Roadie on all social media platforms. Now get in the kitchen and keep on cooking. And hey, remember, it's nice to be nice. This has been a Muzzy Cat production.